Mary Mullen will be introducing our speakers today.
Well, it's my joy to introduce two people, one who I've known for many years and one who I just met this morning. The one I've known for many years is Sol Thea Kelly Jones, who lives just up here in Crawford Drive, about a couple hundred feet from here. She moved here about 10 years ago, and I think, I don't know if that's when I made her acquaintance, but I knew her parents long before that, Sunshine and Joanne. Sol is now a graduate of college, Hampshire College in Amherst, Maine, and she spent her growing up years at the James Reed Unitarian Universalist Congregation. And she's been engaged in social justice activism, as she says, since the womb, because her mother is very much of a social activist, and I think that's her life. But Sol has been an activist and an artist in performing arts since her youngest years. And we've had Proud Theater come here once or twice, and she's the founder of that high school group that is still, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years later, still very much alive and kicking. She has also continued with her social activism, social justice activism, as a college student. She's been to Palestine, she's been to the border areas of Mexico and the United States, and she's written a play. How many have seen that play over at Broome Street Theater some time back? Not too many of you. Well, you missed a good one. So that play was called The Birds That Are Your Hands, How to Start a Fire Under Siege, and it was about the similar plight of people in Palestine and people, Mexicans on the border of our country coming over to our country. The other person who's going to be speaking to us is Nathan Beck, and I found out that Sol and Nathan met in Palestine. He was born and raised in Eastern Africa on the coast of Kenya. He's worked as a volunteer in human rights all around the world, Texas, Tanzania, however you pronounce that, Palestine to Madison, and he's working in the Boys and Girls Club right now in the youth summer programming, and I know I'm going to ask how that compares to being in some of these other places. He's a recent college graduate from a college in Texas. So, with no further ado, Sol and Nathan.
Well, I'm Nathan, and I'll start with why Palestine? I get asked that a lot. I was asked that while I was in Palestine by a lot of the people that I worked with. They said, you know, there's all these other places in the world that are suffering injustices. Why would you choose to go from the U.S. all the way to Palestine? And there are multiple reasons. I think the main one to me was that the occupation of Palestine is one of, I think, the clearest examples of right and wrong, or gross misuse of power. I think there's a side that has no power, and there's a side that has power. There are other sides, other places in the world that don't have these clear distinctions, I don't think. And so that's one of the reasons I thought it was important to go to Palestine. Another reason is because just as, you know, U.S. citizens and the enormous amount of military aid that we send to Israel, we should bear responsibility for that. We should work with everything that we have to go to these places and right these tragedies. And then other things, just the work of witnessing, I think, is so important, especially being a U.S. citizen. Going to a place and being able to witness, being able to see what people are not allowed to see, to be able to see with your own eyes, and to be, for the Palestinians, to be seen, seeing, I guess, to show that there is compassion with your cause in the U.S. I know there are statistics and military aid figures that say the opposite, but there are individuals like Sol and I that are willing, and many dozens and dozens others that we met while there, that are willing to really, really work towards a peaceful and just Palestine. And some of the work that I did there was teaching English. It's one of the skills that I think I have that that I'm able to give anywhere. It's not something that I need to really refine and spend dozens of years working on. I hope to have a skill 10 years from now that is amazing and great, but right now I'm happy with having that skill. And I think it's important to be able to give to these people a way to communicate with U.S. citizens, with people from the U.S. that speak English, with most of the world even. And so I think that was important. I worked in university settings, in community centers, in refugee camps. I taught English in all these different settings and was able to meet all these different people in that way.
So for similar reasons in Palestine, and for a long time involved in all different social justice issues, and I feel like in ways, but one of the issues at that time, and I think things are changing now, which is very exciting, but at that time that we never talked about, and one of the issues kind of out of bounds, I think, for talking about was Israel and Palestine, and was kind of the complexity of that. And oftentimes people say, oh, it's a really difficult issue. You know, there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of emotion, so we won't go there. And I won't, that makes sense. And so for me, in my work, has really been in theater and social justice, and looking at the different ways in which art is mapped as a form of intervention in trauma. Looking at anti-oppression work, looking at the ways in which, on a grassroots level, people are imagining theater to be resistance, if that makes sense. So different Palestinian organizations, for example, that are putting theater at the forefront of their work, both for cultural resistance in a lot of ways, but also for imagining alternative violence. For me, as a US citizen, we give $7 million in aid to Israel every single day. I subsidize the bombs. I pay for the wall. I pay for the concrete. I am part of a system that deems the Arab other as terrorist, as unworthy, as fodder. And so for me to be able to be, as Nathan was saying, in a position of witnessing, but also a position of standing with the courageous Palestinian, Israeli, and international activist who are seeking radical forms of solidarity and undoing of this system, but also of bringing back stories, doing things like this, sharing the information that we don't see on our television, that we don't see any other places. And I worked in Nablus, which is actually this city right here. It's very beautiful, as you can see, one of the oldest continually inhabited places in the entire planet, entire Earth, in Bethlehem area and in Jenin, which is to the north. And then throughout, both of us also work throughout Palestine, throughout the West Bank in different solidarity work. So without further ado, we will get into more of our presentation. But I'm going to start the photos. And we're not going to talk about them individually right now. But if you see one and you're like, oh, that's an image I really want to know more about, we're going to have a lot of time for question and answers. And hopefully we can move it more into a conversation among all of us a little bit later towards the end. So if you see a picture, please remember it and point it out. And we can come back and talk about it. And these are all Nathan and I's photos. And we have a few selections for you. And some of them are very beautiful, like this. And some of them are of really horrifying things. But we want to show you some of the breadth, I think, of Palestine, because it's also a very beautiful place with extraordinary humanity even within it. And the title we have today, we hope to return to. But it really is, a people who are continuing to resist in incredibly creative ways, and for whom breathing and even living is something rather extraordinary.
So often, and I think integral to these conversations is what is occupation. We hear it a lot in lots of different contexts, but so I think we're going to share a lot of experiences that we had witnessing occupation. And so I'm going to start with the very first day that I entered Nablus, the city that you saw in the first picture. So I entered, I'd just flown in two days before. And I'd spent some time in Jerusalem, and then I was going to Nablus, to the West Bank, to the largest industrial city in all of Palestine. And I was going to work for a human rights organization. So getting there is difficult. You go through checkpoints, you get on taxis, different taxis, go through another checkpoint, get on another taxi, go to the next checkpoint, get out, go through, get on another taxi. But finally, I made it through all of this. And I went through Hawara, which is the largest checkpoint right in the entrance to Palestine, to Nablus. And this is a checkpoint, in fact. And so I went through the checkpoint, and I got in, and there were, it was a slow day. There didn't seem to be hardly any people, and I had no idea why, but I found a taxi that would take me to the center of the city. And so I get in, and I start going. He was a really jovial man. We laughed. He joked about George W. Bush. It was a good conversation. We had fun. While we were driving, though, I was noticing out the sides during all this laughter, there were burning tires on the ground. And there was rubble all over the streets. And there was not a single car on any street other than the us. And so this was, I was noticing this dramatically and starting to panic inside, but he was laughing. I was like, okay, it's fine. This is normal. And we get towards the city center. And all of a sudden he stops pretty abruptly, mid-sentence probably, mid-laughter. And he stops abruptly and says, I can't go any further. They will shoot me. And then he pauses and then he's like, but you. He's like, you, because of your skin. And he gestures, or he didn't say skin, he gestures to my skin. He says, he's like, you'll be fine, no problem. And so I was, abrupt stop, abrupt shift, didn't know what to do, but I got out and got my bag. And he pointed, he's like, that's where you're supposed to be going, right down there. And I look around, and I'm in the middle, the city center of a city the size of Madison, downtown capital pretty much. And there's not a soul out. There's not a car out. It was afternoon. It was, daytime. It was probably, if I remember, it was probably between 12 and 2. Not a single soul, not a single car. And so I'm a little worried, and then he points towards that. And then he drives off, and I look towards where he was pointing, and in the distance, and I don't know why I hadn't really realized this. I think it was so much of a shock and quickly paced that I didn't really think about it, but where he pointed, there were military jeeps, and there was machine guns and explosions that I could hear. And at this point, I did something stupid. I decided to trust my U.S. passport and the immense privilege that my white skin gives me to get me out of any trouble that I could get into, and I didn't know what else I could do, so I walked towards it. As I approached this military operation, I saw the first sign of life. Now, keep in mind, there's still fighting in the distance. Jeeps, there are machine gun fire. But the first sign of life I see, I'm entering a new road, and from every corner, every crevice, just from every alleyway, a horde of kids, probably all between the ages of 8 and 14, just emerge from out of these shadows and come kind of surround me. And they all have these curious smiles plastered on their face. This is a couple hundred yards away from a military operation. They have these just curious smiles. They're all looking at me, confused, like, what is this guy doing here? And so I didn't know how to speak any Arabic at that point. I still don't know very, very little. But I communicated in the ways I knew how. I smiled. I laughed with them. They laughed with and probably at me. But it was just this genuine human connection that I felt already 200 yards from a military operation. I felt so full of the human spirit. After a couple of minutes of sharing this, I decided I needed to find out where I was supposed to be, find the organization, and I thought the only way I could do it was to go where he had pointed. And so I point to the tank, or the military jeeps and the operation in the distance, and these kids, and I shrug, and I start walking towards it. And as I walk towards it, all the kids just started to applaud. And so I turn around to smile at the kids, and they're already gone. The last one of them's back in the shadows. And so I turned and kept on walking, and the absurdity, I just remember noting the absurdity. I was smiling hugely at the intensity of the human spirit walking towards a military operation. At this point in the story, I always skip 10 minutes forward. So keep in mind this image, and 10 minutes later, I found myself sitting in the middle of the street facing back where I had looked, with my shirt off. About 10 feet away from me, there was a soldier with a machine gun pointed at me. There was a jeep with soldiers in it talking on the radio while looking over my documents. And I was sitting facing where I'd just been, and right about where I just had been, where I had had the interaction with the kids, there were two military jeeps with soldiers, with machine guns, with body armor, with armor-plated vehicles, shooting at the very same children that I had just witnessed. And during this military operation that shut down an entire city for days, there were luckily only 3 casualties: an 8-year-old boy, an elderly blind man, and another it was a young teenager that died several days later of a coma, that he went into a coma. There's something dwarfing, overwhelmingly helpless about sitting there and witnessing such atrocities. But it is an experience and it is a feeling that I felt often while I was in Palestine. Like you were sitting helplessly, witnessing and watching just the grossest misuse of power and some of the deepest injustices in the world.
This is a picture of that very same operation we're talking about. Operation a couple days later. It's a young girl's house was just torn through in order to get to another house. So that's just a small example. I wanted you to hear the story, so I'm going to start the pictures again as we go on. And this is the same,
store
entirely destroyed. So I think occupation is a hard thing to grasp with the immense privilege we have right here living in the United States. Actually, this photo, really quick before I go on, I want to say something about it. This young boy, as you saw in the picture before, he was killed and shot, like the kids you just heard about, in a city of Jenin, in a refugee camp, and I worked there later in my time after I was in Nablus. And his organs were somehow preserved in his shooting. He was 10 years old, and his father decided that he really wanted to donate the organs of his son as a peace offering, as something of peace. And his organs actually ended up saving the lives of 5 Israeli children, and his son was shot while playing in the street by Israeli soldiers. Coming in, just so you know, he's a soldier. Look at the pictures. So I want to get some of these facts out here, these important things of what occupation looks like, right? So everywhere, imagine this, kind of the architecture of occupation. There's 500 military checkpoints in the West Bank alone. These are places such as this, where people have to wait ludicrous amounts of waiting, a nauseating kind of waiting for hours and hours and hours and hours, and maybe you'll get somewhere, maybe you won't. It's almost a hysterical thing to be in the experience of it. I think so much of my life in Palestine ended up translating into waiting. Waiting to get permits, waiting to see if you can go to the grocery store, waiting to see if your refugee camp, where you're already a refugee in, will be invaded that night. Waiting for return, waiting to see if you'll be able to make it to your university classes, waiting to see, these women waiting to get to their farmland that's cut off by Israeli settlements and is the wall itself. In phoning home, which rarely happened, but in talking and kind of serving in the role as an educator with people back in the States, one thing I tried not to do was share of the horrific violences. I think it's easy. You can talk about the blood. You can talk about the carnage. They're horrifying stories. They're real. It's the collateral. It's the real carnage of people's bodies, of children's bodies. It's like some of the images we saw and did not see of what just happened in Gaza. But then there are the other forms of violence that are every day. And I think for me, they stand out even more because it feels like the slow crushing of an already disparate people. It's a kind of suffocation. It's a wall that actually effectively does not divide Israel and the West Bank, but actually cuts in and severs the West Bank itself, appropriating and annexing 50% of the land. So think of that, 50% of the land, farmland, people that are not able to access their goods, people that are not able to economically flourish in any way, people that aren't able to get to their olive groves, children that aren't able to get to school, families that aren't able to see each other, a husband and a wife who aren't even able to live in the same place anymore. So, I mean, these kind of basic everyday things that I don't think we always think of as horrifying, but are horrifying. There are refugee camps where up to 80%, 90% of people are unemployed, where there's grotesque poverty. A refugee camp I worked in large amount of the time has 28,000 people and 1/4 of a square kilometer of space. So you think of that sort of population density. Gaza is actually the most densely populated place on the entire planet. But you think also those numbers soaring in the West Bank and that kind of systematic violence. The air is policed. This is over the city of Nablus. These are children. But there's different times when these kids are inside because there's planes and drones going overhead, so the air is controlled. And we're not talking about Israel, right? We're talking about the West Bank and Gaza. So that air is policed. The ground itself, it's illegal for Palestinians in most places to use groundwater because that water is controlled through the military that's occupying, so through the Israeli and American military. These are some children in a theater class. Movement is constricted, so we're talking about not only movement from place to place, but when you're thinking of being in tighter and tighter and tighter and smaller places, even the prisons one's body becomes. These are also some other theater classes. Do you want to share the statistic about land and building?
In the past, I think since early 2000, over 18,000 Israeli homes have been built in Palestine. This is in the West Bank, in settlements. Over 18,000 homes have been built for Israeli settlers. In the same time period, only 100 or less than 100 permits have been given to Palestinians to build buildings on their own land. So 18,000 built for Israeli settlers living on Palestine versus 100 permits given to Palestinians.
And these are the illegal settlements under international law, right? So illegal under the UN. These are images of the wall. So you think 30 feet of concrete in some areas, literally severing communities. This is Welcome to Jerusalem. We see right here a UN thing through, right through the very wall. And I think it's one thing, I think you can intellectually know these things. I felt very informed and very, you know, educated about the history of these kind of things. And when you're there, as Nathan was sharing, the absolute grotesque injustice of it is just overwhelming. I think to look at this wall, I mean, people are tiny in comparison to this. This is something, it almost seems like a science fiction movie or something like that. It's horrifying. Do you see this? Peace be with you, Israeli Ministry of Tourism, right on the wall. There's one woman who told me, she talks about drones and planes monitoring everything, incursions almost every single night. And she shares the story of her daughter being shot by a sniper that morning. And she said, for us, there's nowhere safe to move. And she said, Yanni, you know, this is the life. She says, it's a prison here, prison there. What's the difference?
And not only are the West Bank and Gaza imprisoned by, you know, this 30 feet of concrete, but much of the population is imprisoned as well. In fact, 40% of the male population that still lives in Palestine since 1948 has been or is in prison. That's 40% of the male population. I had one day when I was speaking, 40% of the audience stand up. It is shocking. Everyone would know multiple people that had been to prison. And, you know, oftentimes it's asked, why are they in prison? The charge that's most common, if they are lucky enough to get a charge brought against them, is for holding a pebble, holding a stone. The children, too. And children in Israel is classified as 12 and under. If you're 13 and over, you're classified as an adult. When I'm talking about children being arrested, I'm talking about 12 and under, are also arrested for stone throwing, for holding stones often.
In 1 month of the time I was there in April of last year, in one city alone that's smaller than the size of Madison, 120 children, so under the age of 15, had been arrested and imprisoned in that amount of time, Palestinian children, just so you have a sense.
Yeah, and another charge that I've seen multiple times is for having a firecracker. Children having a firecracker and they're deemed as a terrorist. That firecracker is threatening the state of Israel.
You also see university students who resist any. There's tons of political prisoners. One thing that's really interesting in Palestinian society, and I think Nathan had this experience teaching at a university. I work primarily in refugee camps. But education is something that's very hugely valued and hugely elevated as a form of resistance, a form of escape, a form of, you know, supporting your society when you're being crushed. And you can see actually in Gaza, like I would say, the strategic targeting of universities, but also the strategic targeting so that university students and males between the age, so any male around Nathan's age, and probably a few of you here today under the age of 35. So between 15 and 35, men are usually denied permits. Are usually denied permits anywhere in Palestine. So even to move, I worked with a lot of young men and young men who are moving anywhere. They're like, we have education, but for what? We can't even go anywhere to get jobs. We can't even move around, you know, for our families. This is a protest. But I want to talk about, I referred to it earlier, the prisons, not just the literal prisons, but the prisons that one's body becomes. In working a lot with theater and working a lot with unburdening and working with trauma intervention, the statistics are between 85 and 98% of children, and so then I would extend it to adults as well, children in the West Bank and Gaza suffering from post-traumatic stress, but I would say that's almost seems false to say because it's constant stress. It's constant trauma. The youth that I worked with in the camps, it's the night before there's blood stains on the concrete as I'm walking to class. They're showing me their cousin who was shot the night before, but also they're in class and rarely any of them can sleep through the night. The kids have severe urinary problems where there's severe bedwetting, but also not being able to control their bladders out of fear, out of constant trauma. There's chaos, there's hard to see a future. That's one of the things, the ways in which the occupation is internalized. We think of the systems of racism within the United States, right? And like the incarceration of black men, for example, and the heinous, heinous incarceration of black men. In a similar way, these are some kids in my classes. In a similar way, you look at the way in which Palestinians understand the ways in which they're racialized. Understand, it can begin again, if you like. Understand the ways in which their bodies are deemed, their bodies are monitored, the movement of their bodies are monitored, but also the way in which they are deemed as other, as worthless, as fodder. For so many people to even imagine a future is impossible. I worked with a group of young students in Balata camp, and I was trying to get them to do this imaginative improv game, you know, of even envisioning something in the future. And I think it was very idealistic in my mind, but I wanted them to create something, you know? And they couldn't even see beyond tomorrow because their life feels so chaotic. A lot of them couldn't imagine being alive in a few years. And these are, you know, 10, 12-year-olds, 8-year-olds, these children. And finally, one day, there was a little boy who, in an exercise we were doing, was able to see himself in the future. And this is painful for me to say, because I think of it as a success or something, you know, really great that this kid was able to do. But really, I think it would be tragic in any other way. The only way he could see a future for himself was that of being a bird. Being a bird. And for him, it was also being able to see the land of Palestine again. It was being able to see the land of his family who had been displaced, who's originally from the coastal villages of Jaffa and Haifa that we see that are now in Israel proper, who has never seen the ocean, who has only seen, you know, the concrete containment of this area. I was there the week of Passover, and my cousin was actually married to a rabbi and Jewish and living in Jerusalem, and I had wanted to even be able to go and visit her. I was in Bethlehem, which is very close to Jerusalem. I was unable to even get there because of the blockade, the entire blockade of the West Bank during this week of Passover. And for me, in going to James Reeb and kind of growing up, even going to Passover Seders, you know, it's this holiday of real righteousness, of passing over, of overcoming one's oppression. And during this entire week of Passover, the camp, the refugee camp I was living in, Ada, it's right up against the wall. Everyone in the camp did not have water for an entire week. An entire week we didn't have water. Because again, all the water, even though it's from a lot of places from the West Bank, has to be bought back from Israel.
Mm-hmm. And to talk about ways in which people resist is something I wish we had more time to do, but I think we're going to share a short story. Just being there is resisting. It really is. When you're not allowed to move between cities, going to university is this the largest act of resistance that I can imagine. When there are no jobs, there's no movement, and you still pursue education. That's something that I see as ideal. It's something I look up to. I admire so much in them. But another common thing that we encountered a lot, I encountered a lot, when talking with older adults in Palestine, I had a class of mostly older women that had children. And one day we were talking about futures, imaginings. And well, everyone was the same in this. Everyone thought the same. Everyone was saying, you know, we don't really know if we have a future, you know? We have been moved from refugee camp to refugee camp. Our children have not seen our home. My child was born in a refugee camp. My grandson was born in another refugee camp. We don't have much of a future anymore. We don't have these hopes. But for our children, we have hope. across the board, everyone. And I remember the first day me and Sol met, we experienced this several times in conversation with Palestinians, saying, you know, I don't know if I can have what I want in my life, but I know that it is possible that my child can. I just think even being able to imagine that, just like being able to imagine that you are a bird, is such an act of resistance to a place where when the world is resisting against you and against those dreams and against those hopes with everything that it has.
There's an incredible amount of kindness and welcoming. I felt as an American, a U.S. citizen, as a white person, as someone from the outside coming in with my very shaky Arabic, even though I was trying to do something, even though I was witnessing, even despite that, I felt like anger was so justified. And I found this immense welcoming, the immense ability to separate one's government, even the Israeli government, from the Israeli people, if that makes sense. A profound, I think, something far beyond what we're always able to do, such as Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi people, you know, these kind of things. And also, there is an incredible sense of the people who remain, people who, when every part of their society, effective sociocide, really, crushing everything from the economy, the social structures, the very bodies, the very lives of people, continue to stay, continue to live, continue to plant, continue to have children, continue to laugh, continue to have joy, continue to cook, continue to go to school as these young boys traveling through a checkpoint in the middle of the city of Hebron, continue to make kanafe, this sweet treat here, have tea, this is in the city of Nablus. In the city of Hebron, there's settlers living inside the city itself. There's a woman, a settler woman, an Israeli settler, so illegally positioned inside the city, that's actually in an occupied Palestinian home where the family had lived there for thousands, literally traced their lineage thousands of years to this single dwelling, was reoccupied. And she stuffed the face of a Palestinian boy with rocks and punched him in the mouth. Another settler woman that stood on her rooftop and sprayed, this is in Hebron, a sign, you see reminiscence here. This is also in Hebron, a checkpoint in the middle of the city. And sprayed the elder Palestinian man's spice shop, you know, beautiful spices below, with water, destroying entire things. So these are these other kinds of violences. And then I like to say sometimes it's not the guns, and sometimes it is. Sometimes it's a young man's father named, his son was named Samir, and his son was severed by a bullet that also severed the body of his best friend crouching behind him. And Samir, it's really emotional to me, I knew this man really well, and he saw a straight shot, he saw a straight shot of the Israeli soldier, and he said he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it. And every single person in his family is dead. This is inside a refugee camp. You see up there there's women kind of gathered, that's their main street. You think of these tiny corridors, that's the main street of the refugee camp. These are in a theater class. Anyways, there's one thing we always hear, and I think we always hear about the attacks. I think even in the Obama beginning quote, which I found hopeful in many ways, it's the most radical thing we've heard, you know, for a bit. But the thing that's interesting is even the constant attacks. We hear the constant attacks. I mean, I think that's the narrative we hear about Palestinians as terrorists, as others, frightening, as scary, and I think even internalized probably in us, these ways we need to rip it off. There's this woman, and it's actually a character I wrote in the play that it's based on a couple different women. Older woman, I was sitting with this older woman, and she says, you know, they always think of us, they always think of this as so violent. And there's a former president or prime minister of Israel, Golda Meir, and she says this famous line, and she says, as soon as the Arabs love their children more than they hate us, we will have peace. So you think of what this is, and she says, Arab women? She's like, so you're saying our wombs sow the hatred, our wombs sow the hatred, not the bombs, not the bullets, not the prisons. You know, that the hatred is coming from inside of us, not from these things. And she says, look at all of us. You know, you talk about violence, you think of more than 99% of Palestinians as non-violently, creatively resisting every single day, even in living, even in the protests you've seen, even in hanging laundry here, even in painting on the wall, in coming into a class and showing up to be a clown. And she says, look at this. She says, every moment we do not destroy you, we are nonviolent. She says, look at us. She says, look at our hands. She says, look at all that our hands don't do. So I want to leave you with that, when even breathing itself, even images like this, is defiance. We want to open it up to questions right now and kind of a broader conversation we can have, and we'll take as many as we can get, but also please, again, if you have any questions about the pictures, I know we haven't been able to go through them. So these are olive trees right here, and these are actually groves. I'll do it to a big picture. Oh, no. Yeah, very, very ancient. These are beautiful. This is in a village of Yunnan, and there's about, can everyone hear me? There's about 200, oh, sorry, I'll go back. There's about, so beautiful, I mean, gorgeous, gorgeous olive groves, as you can see. It's a village of about 200, and on the hills surrounding it, it's less than 200, isn't it? About 200, less than 200. Families have been there for generations. Their whole income is, you know, the olives, the olive oil, olive trees, everything, and tending to these fields. All around here are settlements that have taken most of the land, and they're on the hills, and every single day, the settlers walk through with large machine guns. Remember, it's illegal for Palestinians to have weapons, which is something we never think about. But illegal for Palestinians to have weapons, but Israeli settlers often carry machine guns, in addition to soldiers, and are oftentimes much more violent, actually, I would say, even than soldiers.
In Al-Yunnan, there are oftentimes teenagers with machine guns. There are many experiences from friends of ours who were accosted by 14 and 15-year-old Israeli settlers with machine guns in the village.
And these are if you think of religiously fundamentalist people in the United States, these would be people that are religiously fundamentalist too. So you think of people that are religiously fundamentalist who believe oftentimes that Arab people, you know, every imaginable thing we could think, right, of people who are homophobic or, you know, something like that. If you think of Fred Phelps, you know, with a machine gun, like his children armed with machine guns patrolling, like, my family's, my parents are gay, so my family's, you know, backyard. It's something closer to that, if that makes sense. And there actually, there's an international observer house there, so it's ecumenical support. And there's has to almost be a constant presence, or else the houses get taken. Does that make sense? So they come in almost every night and try to burn houses, try to take houses, these kind of things. So the presence being there actually does make a difference. But every night, Nathan and I actually stayed and provided relief work so the ecumenical support workers could be somewhere else. Does that make sense? And could actually go and get groceries and these kind of things. There's large strobe lights, large stadium-style lights that patrol this entire village. Of just 200 people that they don't even usually have electricity, I would say, most of it. A very, very rural, very rural village with huge strobe lights the whole night to just even let them know they're being watched, as an example. But your question was, how do they make it?
The short answer is, I don't know. but I found an immense amount of hospitality between Palestinians. I don't think that there would be able to be a Palestinian who is homeless. I think he would be taken in. I think there are some people that are wealthy in Palestine. It does have, it's a capitalist system that allows a few people to get very wealthy, but the vast majority aren't. But most of them share everything. Even us, we were given so much. We were given free falafels by a man who probably struggles, you know, every day. We were given, we were offered places to stay all the time. So I think my answer is that it's an extremely generous society.
And I would say something more with that. There's one story I do want to think about, because I think the thing about poverty is interesting. I know Nathan's worked in Tanzania and experienced an entirely different form of poverty. But this kind of, it's an interesting thing, because there's even families, we don't always think, I think, of the dire poverty that's also happening in Palestine right now, the malnourishment, the lack of resources. But even when these shops do flourish and these systems of sharing and these kind of systems of kind of finding alternative economies and alternative ways of adapting and making something work, like for example, there's one shop, the middle street in Bethlehem was severed by the wall, so it used to be like a downtown State Street kind of area, and it's now there's a wall through the middle of it, right? So obviously it isn't that anymore. But they have like a wall observatory cafe, which is, I mean, you want to laugh as if it's funny. I mean, and it's really horrifying if you think about it, but it's people who are doing everything they possibly can to survive, if that makes sense. But anyways, while I was in Nablus, they're the only top, the murder rate, all these things are extremely, extremely low, right? So you never even hear about this. But there was a terrible thing the people in the town of Nablus did, and they, I mean, terrible, I'm having quotes around it, but they raided, apparently a group of people raided a UN little storage area to get the flour that had been condemned as not fit for human beings. Does that make sense? So that is how, just to say that, there's such pride and such dignity. Like, I had kids that would wear the same outfit every single day I saw them, but it would their hair would always be done nice. Do you know what I mean? So kind of the pride in that, but still, if you think of the underneath reality of dire, I would say dire poverty for the majority.
Really quick, I want to answer the Nablus one. This is our only Palestinian village. Or half, does that make sense?
Yeah.
These are Palestinian villages, or Palestinian, sorry, buildings, offices, houses, and kind of things. It's about the size of Madison.
And on the top of the hills around it, there's military bases on both of the hills surrounding it. So it's inside the valley. There are Israeli military bases on the hills, but it's only Palestinian. It's Arab, almost primarily. But within the Arab population, there's huge amounts of Christians, which I think, and especially in Nablus, which I think a lot of people forget. Nablus is the site where Jacob's Well is, and the church that holds it still. It's where, you know, it's Shechem biblically. So there's still a huge Christian population, and I worked with several. And the university, this is true. The university I worked with was 53% of the students were women. And we think of this in an Arab culture. And I worked in the English department, so all of my students were women. And I've had the same, I studied English, and so I had the same experience in the U.S. But now these women, we had the first class that I taught at one setting. The first day, we sat around and we organized. We're like, how can we do this? How can we get there? You have to go through the checkpoint this day. What time can you make it? We worked cooperatively to find out a way to accommodate as many people as we could, and we could not accommodate everyone, which was so intensely sad. There were some people that, because of the wall, because of the checkpoints, they can't make it. University students they have to wait hours to get into Nablus. If they're from outside village, to get to university oftentimes takes hours. Sometimes daily. Sometimes the checkpoints are just closed. Sometimes there is no getting through. So it is, university students in Nablus, it is intensely hard. I don't know how they do it.
I'm going to say one thing quickly on that, and then I want to introduce someone in the back who has some incredible resources for all of you and is an amazing resource in our community, and then we can open it up. I think there needs to be a transition point. Right, okay. One thing, there's a woman I talked to, and she said, why can't the Palestinians just play violins? Just do music, just do these kind of things, and what, like as a form of resistance. And what coming up to me is a story of this one young man I knew from a university, speaking of university things. He actually was studying to play the violin in a very famous university in Palestine. And to make it to his classes, he had to wait in a checkpoint for over 5 hours. So he'd wait in the checkpoint, and then finally they ended up saying, anybody from the city of Nablus cannot travel to Ramallah, where Birzeit University, where he was studying, was. You just don't get a permit. Sorry, your university classes are over. So he decided to go through the hills instead. He got shot in the leg, is permanently, actually then his family found him, carried him down, tried to get him through the checkpoint. He lost too much blood in his leg to be able to save the leg and get to the hospital in time, which was also in Ramallah. Now he's not able to travel to university classes at all. He's not able to play the violin. He's had to go into a different kind of work just to try to support his family for the large medical bills they have with his leg. So you think of these kind of things that I think, from our view out here, can look, well, of course. There's another story, very, very quickly, of a circus group who's trying to meet together with an Israeli circus group. So Palestinian circus group, Israeli circus group, they say, oh, wouldn't this be beautiful? You know, united under the power of the laugh, right? Clowns coming together across borders. But he can't even make it to Jerusalem, the Palestinian man, to even meet with the other clowns. So how, he says, is peace even achievable? You know, how is this, he says, this ignorance of you know, the Americans, of the Israelis, because we don't even have the power to get there. Can't they come here, he says, to meet? But I think that gross power difference, the crushing of the people. First, okay.
Please join me in thanking Saul and Nathan especially.